Welcome to Volume 3 of Capital Ideas Live, a live teleconference of the Alabama Forest Owners Association. We're joined by a number of panelists who will discuss topics ranging from the upcoming state political races to trends in rural real estate values. We're going to talk about pine straw production, pine beetles. We'll talk about improving your deer herd, and we'll also learn about some land for sale. Finally, we'll find out how the stumpage market is behaving these days. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association. I'll be your host for today's 30-minute teleconference. You can learn more about the speakers and about their topics by visiting our website, alabamaforestowners.com. Membership information in the Forest Owners Association, as well as a list of the services offered by the association, can be found there. Why don't we begin our discussion with Boyd Kelly. Boyd is a familiar face at the state legislature where he works on behalf of the Alabama Forestry Association. He's their government affairs director. Boyd, when I'm driving down the highway, I can't help but notice there must be an election on November the 7th. I'd like to ask you to focus on the seats in both the Alabama Supreme Court and the Court of Civil Appeals. Why is it that these court races would be important to forest landowners in Alabama?
Well, Hayes, I think that perhaps there's a couple of examples that would illustrate that best. One, in the 1996 Court of Civil Appeals ruled unanimously against a trespasser who sued a landowner for injuries he suffered while he was trespassing. The Supreme Court reversed that decision by one vote, and the trespasser subsequently ended up receiving over $1 million. Just last year, the Court of Civil Appeals unanimously overturned a Mobile Circuit Judge's ruling that denied the Delaneys some current use valuation on some property they had near Springdale Mall. The county appealed to the Supreme Court. Oral arguments have been held. We're waiting for them to rule. We're hoping that the majority will follow the law and uphold the Court of Civil Appeals. No one expects preferential treatment, but we do want them to follow the law.
It sounds like the Supreme Court and Court of Civil Appeals has some influence on the trespass issues and damages and also current use. You work for the Alabama Forestry Association, and it's recognized, I believe, as a politically active group that sometimes makes endorsements in political campaigns. Has the AFA made any endorsements in these races?
Yes, we have. We've endorsed some candidates that are campaigning on the promise that they'll fairly interpret the law as passed by the legislature, that they will avoid judicial activism or making law from the bench. One thing they have in common is they. Another thing they have in common is they're all Republicans. We've endorsed Forest PAC, which is our official political action committee, has endorsed Supreme Court candidates Roy Moore, Lynn Stewart, Champ Lyons, Tom Woodall, and Bernard Harwood. And for the Court of Civil Appeals, we've endorsed Craig Putman, John Crawley, and Glenn Murdoch. And I believe that links to those candidates' webpages have been established on the Forest Owners webpage.
Okay, and that's alabamaforestowners.com. You know, the Supreme Court races have not been traditionally thought of as having high political stakes if you look back over history, but today these races draw a lot of attention. How did it evolve that these races are so important these days?
That's true. Until the early 90s, only lawyers were interested in these races, but that changed when the business community saw their comprehensive package of tort reform bills that they had passed through the legislature in 1987. The business community saw these struck down by a liberal activist court. The state earned a reputation as tort hell, and economic development began to suffer. The business community fought back in 1994 by supporting Chief Justice Perry Hooper over the incumbent Sonny Hornsby. Y'all may remember that that war really escalated when the plaintiff trial lawyers used their clout with the Democrat Party to try to steal the election from Hooper by counting unwitnessed illegal absentee ballots. It took over a year and two trips to the U.S. Supreme Court before Hooper was allowed to take his seat. Then in 1996, the politics heated up even more with the trial lawyers funding an expensive dirty campaign against Harold C. You may remember the skunk ad. C won that race, and then in 1998, three seats were up for grabs. Both sides spent a record amount of money. The conservative side won two of those three seats and established a slim conservative majority on the Supreme Court. This year, the reason the interest is so high, five of the nine seats are up for grabs. A tremendous amount of money is going to be spent because the philosophical balance is at stake for the next 6 years with just this one election. The same is true for the Court of Civil Appeals, where three out of the five seats are on the ballot.
All right. Well, thank you for that political perspective from Boyd Kelly. Thank you for joining us, Boyd.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're next joined by Dr. Walter Privat, who's a professor at Auburn University in the Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology Department. Walt's research and extension responsibilities includes farm real estate, and he's published a book called Alabama Farmland Values and Cash Rents. Walt, in putting this book together, you've gained a historical perspective on farmland values. If you had the opportunity to say something to a young forest owner who's never seen a real decline in rural land values, what would you say to him?
Well, I'd certainly say that they should be aware that farm real estate values do increase and decrease over time, and we have a number of events in Alabama history that speak to this. We can go back 150 years and talk about basically seven events that we have seen, you know, substantial increases as well as substantial declines in farm real estate value.
When was the last time you saw a decline in the recent past?
In the recent past, the decline that occurred was during the recession of the 1980s. We saw Alabama farmland values decrease from approximately $910 per acre to $786 per acre, which represents about $124 an acre price decline. Now, this was primarily due to higher interest rates, financial instability, where we had a lot of inflated balance sheets during that particular time period. We also had some extremely poor export markets for ag commodities, both farm commodities as well as our timber products, and due to this combination of factors, it resulted in depressed farmland value market.
I take it that it took a few years to correct itself.
Yes, that's correct. Primarily, this recession had an effect from 1981 through 87. We really saw recovery begin to take place in the early 90s. And has lasted, until 2000. So
let me ask you about the trends that you see in the timberland valuations in the last, say, 10 years.
We try to observe the differences in terms of cutover timberland, and then also timberland with the land and the trees.
Mm-hmm.
During the last 10 years, we've seen fairly consistent growth in the cutover timberland values, and those increases have been quite significant.
All right, so we have consistent growth in the timber in the portion of the economy dealing with land only.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, whenever you compare that with timberland that consists of land and trees, both value for the land and the trees. We have also seen growth in that area, but there have been some weaknesses, particularly in 1993 and 1997. We saw some declines, small declines anyway, which we're attributing primarily to the timber value.
To the timber part of that. Well, thank you for that historical perspective, Walt. Our next guest will help us think about natural regeneration of pines. We're joined by O.M. Becton, who's a forester for Scotch Lumber Company in southwest Alabama. He's been following the natural regeneration of pine trees for a long time. Mr. Becton, what should forest owners be thinking about who practice natural regeneration? What should they be thinking about now?
Well, if they have the stands prepared and ready, you know, for a regeneration cut, this is the time of the year to cut back for natural regeneration. But I want to emphasize the planning and preparation part of it. Because if you don't plan and prepare for natural regeneration, you're relatively assured of a failure. But if you do plan and prepare and do what's needed, you are almost assured of success, mm-hmm. you know.
What things should they be doing?
First of all, you have to select, this sort of goes without saying, but you got to select a stand that has proper, adequate seed source. You know, if you, I'm going to think, primarily about loblolly pine. That's mm-hmm. the primary pine tree we work with. So you got to have adequate loblolly pine there for a seed source. And it needs to be mature, you know, or approaching maturity. Then as soon as you determine that it is a candidate for natural regeneration, then you need to run a fire through it, prescribe burn it in the dormant season. And the same year or the next year, you need to work through it with an improvement cut, because chances are there would be, you know, thick patches and clumps of pines that's too thick. You need to thin these out, and then there'd be a hardwood component in there that you would need to cut out, because you'd want to remove all the hardwood in the area that you're going to regenerate back to pine.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking these, you know, thinning the pines out, this will allow sunlight to hit the full crown, and the trees in a few years will put on pine cones on the sides of the crown as well as on the top.
Okay, so some of the things you need to be thinking about now are the seed source, running a fire through the dormant season, and also an improvement cut.
Right, and then after you make the, this is a relatively long-term process planning for natural regeneration. I'm going to say it's between 5 and 10 years to do to do an excellent job of mm-hmm. preparation. And then after you do the cut, you'd need to burn again in the dormant season, you know, 2 or 3 years after the cut. And this would remove all the logging delays where you can get a good distribution of seed when you do make the harvest cut, and the seed can get to the mineral soil.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Becton. Thank you for joining us. We want to shift gears now to an enterprise that's in its infancy in Alabama. We're talking about pine straw production. We're joined by Don McLean, who's a representative of a company that manufactures a baling machine that can collect and bale pine straw. Don, how hard would it be for a forest owner to get into the pine straw business?
I guess first you might want to ask why bale pine straw at all.
Mm-hmm.
Studies have shown that a landowner can realize as much income from straw production over the life of the stand as he can from the timber. And currently in a mature stand, as a generalization, you're talking about gross income of $1,000 per acre per baling, which is normally once a year. You have to assume a mature stand at least 8 years old generally, where it is canopied over to prevent any weed regrowth. The stand would need to be clear of brush, briars, weeds, and that sort of stuff, so you can go in and run a rake and a baler. Prime needle production is at about 15 years age of the stand. So it'll depend on the individual stand as to how much work needs to be done.
What equipment would a landowner need to accomplish this?
Of course, you'd need a tractor, about 18, 20 horsepower. He'd either need to hand rake the pine straw, or we do sell mechanical rakes, both self-propelled and tractor-mounted. And then, of course, you'd need a baler. And we offer a mini-round baler, which is becoming more popular for the commercial landscaping market because it saves so much labor spreading the straw.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have the small-chambered square baler.
All right. Well, I believe we have a link to your company on our website, and those who are interested in finding out more about what equipment it takes can visit that site. Thank you for joining us, Don.
I appreciate it, and anyone can email me with any questions directly from my site.
All right, very good. Lloyd Brown joins us from Eastern Pennsylvania. He's president of Intopath. It's a company that markets technology that's aimed at reducing certain insect population Lloyd's been conducting some experiments that are designed to reduce the pine beetle infestation in our southern pine tree species. Lloyd, I understand that some of the work you're doing involves helping the natural enemies of the pine beetle survive and live long enough to keep the pine beetle population in check. Tell me how this process works.
Yes, it's a novel approach to pest control, and we chose the southern pine beetle to work with first because it evolved in the southern part of the United States, and it has eight species of Hymenopterus parasitoids. A parasitoid is a parasite that always kills its host. Six of those are rather common in most of the pine beetle infestations. Work we did at the University of Arkansas showed that when these little parasitoids emerge from the bark after having consumed a pine beetle larvae, they have eggs ready to lay on other pine beetle larvae in their reproductive system. However, if they don't find food within 24 hours, we found that they start resorbing those eggs for nutrition, and at the end of 7 days would have completely resorbed the entire reproductive tract. So we felt if we provided a nutritious food in the environment, we would make these guys more efficient.
All right, so you're providing food to the natural enemy, then, of the pine beetle.
That's right.
How do you provide
the white hat guys so they can feed on the back black hat guys.
Okay. How do you go about giving the food, distributing the food to them?
We have two methods. One, we've formulated the food into small balls that we can fire into the trees using CO2-powered rifles, and the balls hit the bole of the tree and burst open and splatter the food up and down the tree.
Right.
And the second way, especially areas like where the outbreak you've had in Alabama this past 2 years, we've developed a aerial application. Last fall, we discovered these little parasitoids feed up in the crowns of trees, so this allowed us to apply it from the air as well.
All right. Well, Lloyd, we certainly wish you well on that endeavor. We appreciate you're looking into that issue for us and telling us about it, and we believe we have a link to your site where members of the audience can find out more about what you're doing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, while Lloyd is working on enhancing the natural enemies of the pine beetle, Tim Gables is on the ground helping landowners cope with the continuing damage that's caused by pine beetles. Tim's a consulting forester with Chattahoochee Valley Forestry Consultants. Tim, Alabama has experienced a great increase in pine beetle infestations this summer. What are some management techniques that landowners can do to reduce their risk?
Hey, there's several things that can be done, all geared towards reducing stress on pine trees. One thing is, as soon as stands become of merchantable size, they should be thin to allow the healthier trees more room to grow. There are some pesticides that can be applied, although they're generally shied away from just because of cost and health concerns. And another area that we're beginning to look into here is the use of natural or man-made barriers to reduce the spread of the pine beetle throughout a solid pine stand, especially with all of the new plantations that are being planted every season.
What do you mean by natural barrier? How does one produce something like that?
Well, a natural barrier would be something such as a streamside management zone or any kind of woody component that's in a stand that would break up the continuity of a pine stand. There's, as far as man, or artificially making these zones, things such as when you're thinning a stand, you cut out strips 60 to 80 foot wide, in different areas throughout the stand. Also, on newly planted stands, you can leave these strips throughout the stands just to break up the continuity. And these strips go hand in hand with the recreation market that seems to be on the rise now as far as deer hunting, turkey hunting, quail hunting, that you can plant various wildlife forage on these areas that will increase the chance of seeing game and also help you to maybe increase your hunting lease income.
So it sounds like these strips can be part of a streamside management zone or as part of what you might have as a food plot in any event.
Right.
How does this strip slow down an infestation of pine beetles?
Well, the pine beetles, they jump or fly from the nearest tree, and there's only a certain distance that they will fly. Generally, when you get an infestation, you go in and cut out the infected trees as well as a buffer strip of non-infected trees that is about as wide as the trees are high. So if you leave a 60 to 80 foot strip down through there, it kind of creates a moat, if you will, that would prevent the beetles from jumping across and continuing on throughout a stand. Also, in these more open areas, your air temperatures are a little higher, which tends to retard the movement of the beetles in that way.
All right. If someone is participating in CRP, is that program compatible with what you're discussing?
Yes. Generally, depending on how the landowner sign up, they may have to leave 15 to 20% of the acreage open in wildlife food plots, and rather than sticking the food plots in a square block down in the corner of the field, they can utilize these 60 to 80 foot strips throughout the stand to break up the continuity as well as increase the edge effect, which enhances the wildlife habitat.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Tim Gables, consulting forester with Chattahoochee Valley Forestry Consultants. We're next joined by Brian Murphy, who's the executive director of the Quality Deer Management Association located in Watkinsville, Georgia. This association was formed over 10 years ago in 1988. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting a sustainable future for high-quality deer hunting. Brian, what is meant exactly by this term, quality deer management?
Well, Hayes, it's a phrase that's been coined over the last 10 years, I guess, essentially when our organization was founded and even before that. It's about balancing deer herds with their habitat and also improving the age structure of the buck population, which are typically grossly over-harvested, and doing that by protecting those younger age class bucks and at the same time harvesting enough female deer, particularly the adults, to keep that herd under control.
Okay. How does it differ then from more traditional methods of deer management?
Well, the traditional method that most hunters, in fact, grew up on was that you harvested any legal buck that you possibly could and shot very few does. And, of course, that was the right strategy to let those small herds rebound, which obviously they have done well and truly. Most of the southern states now have well in excess of a million deer in each. So now it's about trying to turn the tables and go in a new direction, and that's the quality deer management direction.
If a landowner practiced some of these principles, how could he expect his lease prices to respond if he did what you're recommending?
Well, of course, there's two ways there to receive economic benefit from quality deer management, one of which is the lease price, and there's no question that hunters out there are willing to pay a top dollar for a lease that has quality deer herd on them, and particularly, you know, a good buck population. And secondly, by keeping that herd under control, they're going to save with damage to crops and young seedlings.
Mm-hmm. If a landowner wanted to find out more information about quality deer management, how would he obtain this information?
Well, the easiest way would be to call our toll-free number, and that's 800-209-DEER, or check out our website at qdma.com. I think it's important quickly to mention that about 7,000 of our 12,000 members are, in fact, landowners, most of which are forest landowners, and also that we actively work with most of the timber companies throughout the South, including Mead, International Paper, Gulf States, and St. Joe. So clearly there is a benefit to the forest landowner to practice quality deer management.
All right. That number again is 800-209-DEER. Thank you for joining us, Brian Murphy. We're next joined by Pete Bertucci from Mobile, Alabama. Pete is a vice president and property manager for AmSouth Bank. Pete, I think you're going to tell us about some offerings that you had for land for sale in Kanaka County, Alabama. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Hayes, thank you. We're representing some owners that are selling 178 acres of timberland in Kanaka County. The property is in the community of Range. It's a pretty piece of property. It's comprised of 65 acres of pasture and 113 acres of timberland. That timberland is predominantly upland longleaf pine. There's a stream that runs through the property. There's some potential pond sites, and you know, we feel the property has some potential for real potential for recreational use, but there's also a good bit of timber on the property.
Is this being sold with an auction type situation with a bid, or through another method?
It's going to be a sealed bid method. We have the property is open for people to inspect and cruise the timber up until November 2nd. On November 2nd, we'll have the bid. It'll be at 11 a.m. on that Thursday. The process is we have bid packages available here if individuals are interested. They need to contact us. We'll get them a bid package. It's got all the maps and information about the property, and it's got a form for submitting their bid.
All right, so they can contact you at 334-438-8390.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, sir.
Get a bid package. All right, thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Our final guest is Dr. Tom Harris, who's a professor at the University of Georgia Forestry School and is a publisher of a well-known publication called TimberMart South. Tom, we wanted to invite you to come and talk with us a little bit about how the timber market is looking these days. What are you seeing?
Hayes, the prices have been falling slightly during the summer and the spring. Saw timber prices were down about 6% second quarter over the first quarter, and pulpwood was down almost 15%. So we're seeing some weak prices due. The drought has had a big impact, and also some weak end product markets. But with the rain and improved pulp markets, things could turn around as we go into the winter.
So this decline you're talking about of 6% for sawtimber and 15% for pulpwood is just in one quarter?
Right, second quarter over the first quarter of this year.
That's a pretty steep drop in that short a length of time, isn't it?
It is, particularly in pulpwood, it was a fairly sharp decline.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's...
Sawtimber is still up over where it was a year ago, however, so it's not... That may be a little misleading.
Just have to adopt a little longer-term perspective, I guess. Should how close should forest landowners follow the stumpage market? Should they be watching this thing every day, week, month, quarter, or what?
We gather information throughout the quarter and publish once a quarter and post it on our website, which is now timbermart-south.com, and provide our newsletter, which gives Southwide data on a quarterly basis. And we think that will give the landowner a pretty good indication of what's happening in the market.
All right, so a landowner can go to timbermartsouth.com and find out some more information about that.
That's right.
All right. When is the next information going to become available?
In early October. We'll publish in about three more weeks.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Tom Harris. We appreciate that from University of Georgia Forestry School. That's all the time we have for this issue of Capital Ideas Live. Our thanks go to our panelists, Boyd Kelly, Walt Privat, O.M. Becton, Don McLean. We were also joined by Lloyd Brown, Tim Gables, Brian Murphy, Pete Bertucci, and Tom Harris. If you're interested in other topics that we haven't covered today, you can look at the bottom of our website, alabamaforestowners.com, and look at some of the other topics that we're following and we'll perhaps present on another occasion. Please visit us again on October the 18th at 10 o'clock a.m. Central for Volume 4 of Capital Ideas Live. This is a live teleconference sponsored by the Alabama Forest Owners Association, brought to you as a public service. We hope this has been of some help to you. Thanks for joining us as we bring you the latest news and information in forestry from the Alabama Forest Owners Association. Thanks for joining us.